Thou art saved.
The living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
Hey, George.
Hey, Lions. How's it going?
You know what I spent my day doing was carrying out a pointless vendetta and then raising my children to continue my vendetta unquestioningly after my death. And most crucially, to make sure that they make their children continue. Really, it's just some sort of legacy, I can't think of a good word for it, but it's like a vendetta legacy.
Like a legacy of, it's almost biblical in a way, you know?
Begets and begats.
It's true. And although in the Bible, even the Bible stopped at the fourth generation, you know?
Are we going to use the Bible as a standard of literature? Oh my God, even in the Bible, they only had one flood.
Yeah. I mean, it was a hell of a flood, but they did only do that once. But yes, no, we played Rogue Legacy, which I love it for two reasons. One is because obviously the entire thing is based upon your children and your children and your legacy, right? But this is also a legacy from the original game, you know? So it's just that tickles my brain in that very, very nice, special way.
Yes. No, I have in my notes to explain that. If you didn't explain it, so I'm glad we are 100% on the same page with that, because it's just one of those, you know what it is? It's the song Yellow Diamond sings, "What's the use in feeling blue?" Because it's what's the use in feeling sad, and also what's the use in feeling at all, because her name is Blue. And it's not that deep and nuanced of a use of the English language, but it's just really satisfying anyway.
Well, I think that to me, it's kind of what I really imagine is that people were sitting down and it's okay, we want to make a sequel to Rogue. We're going to make Rogue 2. And somebody was just okay, so what are we going to do? It's we're going to have it be your children, carrying on the line. It's like a legacy, like this game is. Incentivize that employee, they are now the CEO, as well they should be, because again, so this is a new Nostalgia Goggles, right? So as opposed to talking about our nostalgia experience for this, do we want to talk about how we came across this game?
I do, and the last thing I want to say though is the gap here is non-trivial, because whenever a game is called a roguelike, they're referencing a game from 1980, right? Way back in the day. And this game, which is apparently referred to as a roguelite, because it's not a full refresh of the universe every single time you die, which I like a lot, and we will get into later. This came out in June of 2013. So that even makes the title a little bit more delicious, because there's a lot of roguelikes between Rogue and Rogue Legacy, and this is really trying to not just build on what the original Rogue set down, but continue an evolution that hasn't stopped, right? There will be many more. There's been hundreds of more roguelike games released since Rogue Legacy was released, right? So this is an ongoing legacy, which fits in really, really nicely.
Absolutely. No, and I thought, we'll obviously get into, the visuals, the sound, the mechanics, but I thought that they did overall a good job kind of saying a lot of games, literally this game created the genre. I mean, it is on par with Metroidvania, where it's just kind of it is the genre. I am the state, So that's good. But they really kind of looked at it and said okay, so then if we're going to pin this and say we are doing Rogue Legacy, how do we approach that in a way that it's not just another roguelike? This has to be the roguelike. It has to be a spiritual successor to it. And I thought that they made some very interesting decisions to maintain that, but also update it and, make it relevant.
So how did you discover this game? Because my story is short. You introduced me to this game. And
yes,
and I was really shocked that I had never heard of it, because I was like, this is kind of right up my friggin' alley. Like, I'm surprised that I missed this. Granted, my life was very tumultuous at this particular time in history. Like, I had just moved, I just started a new job, I just got married, my wife was pregnant, like a lot of crap going on in the middle of 2013. But I really surprised I hadn't heard about this until you were like, oh, we should totally friggin' play this game because it's awesome. So what is your story?
Well, and it was funny too, just to from my seat on your story, was when we were just discussing, like, oh, you know, what do we want to do for another Nostalgia Goggles? I'm like, well, I've actually been playing Rogue Legacy. We should do that. It's really good. And you're like, what? I was like, really? Like, I was floored that you hadn't heard about it. I was like how? There's no way that I stumbled my way into this before you. I was like, yeah, no, check it out, and sent you the link. And then I think you texted me back saying, like, this looks awesome. Let's do it. And so then that was. And thus it became the reality that we now inhabit. So for me, actually, I had heard of this game because, you know, like, I listen to a lot of, like, gaming, you know, YouTube channels and things like that, you know, so that way I can continue to educate myself. So that way I can speak in a, you know, more educated way about what we do here. So I had heard this game, like, this name kind of floating around and mentioned a number of times. And then what happened was Teddy, my son, really has taken to playing Celeste, which was another one that we did on Nostalgia Goggles. And I didn't uninstall from my PlayStation. And he has just been playing the bejesus out of that, by which I mean he plays it, dies a whole bunch of times, and then makes me play it.
Right.
So
same difference.
Yeah. So I had become weary of playing Celeste because it's not a low key game, you know, like, it's intentionally frustrating, you know.
Yeah, and to have someone else come to you and angrily hand you the controller and be like, ah, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, so I was searching for other games for Teddy to play, and I was like, you know what game would be very similar, but, you know, like, within the same style, because I tried a couple of different ones and none of them were landing. And I realized, I'm like, well, let's just look at 2D side scroller. Went with Shovel Knight, right? I was like, I'm going to go buy Shovel Knight, you know, because I know that that's in the same genre of, like, you know, nostalgia and all this sort of stuff. And literally while it was downloading, it was like, people who liked this also liked these other games. And Rogue Legacy was on there and it was on sale for $5. And I said, well, I would be remiss to not buy this, right?
At these prices, I should buy two.
Ah, Zoidberg, you're finally becoming a crafty consumer. Hi, I'll take eight. So I just went ahead and purchased that, and, you know, started playing it. I'm like, this is really, really enjoyable. So then that was kind of how I stumbled across it. It was just an add-on buy, and I've actually played that way more than I've played Shovel Knight. So
every time you say that a, like, an Instagram ad or a people who liked style ad actually led to you spending money, someone in San Francisco gets their wings. Like, it's some tech bro just, like, got a little shiver and was like, oh, see, these ads totally work. It doesn't matter that they fail like 99.9% of the time, but the fact that you bought a game, which led to me also buying the game because of a people who like this also purchased, like, that's it.
Yep, that's it. That just justified their salary for the year.
I will say, yeah, when you turned me onto this game, and I looked it up, and I don't want to exaggerate and say that the downtime between you recommending it and me buying it was like under an hour, but I don't think it was much longer than that, because I was looking at it and, like, I watched a little bit of the gameplay and, like, I read about it and I was like, man, this looks pretty fun. This is kind of an interesting premise. And then I went to, because I actually didn't get it on console, I bought it for PC. So I went to their website, and their marketing website is actually, like, this kind of silly marketing humor that is, like, endearing and not frustrating. And I was like, oh man, I could buy this cheaper somewhere else, but I really just want to give this guy my money. So I bought it for, I mean, big air quotes, full price. It was still only $15. And now, you know, I have it on Steam and I blah, blah, blah. But I was like, this is, you know, so another guy in San Francisco just went like, ooh, marketing copy sells, right? Like, there's something to be said for a company that has, like, a like an end-to-end experience. Like playing the game is good, but also like interacting with the people who made the game is good. Like watching Let's Plays attracts like a certain kind of player. So you get like, there's a kind of a community around it. And that sounds really lame and terrible. And I think we should immediately move on.
So to visuals. Visuals, this game certainly had them. What were your thoughts?
So I'm going to start with a nitpicky thing because I want to know if you noticed this. And if not, I really hope I'm about to shatter some glass for you. The game is all pixel art, right? It's 100% pixel art minus maybe like a couple particle effects here and there. But I don't think so. I think it's actually 100% pixel art. But the thing that I noticed is they are using pixel art for aesthetic reasons, not as an artistic limitation. And what that means is there are times when the resolution of one sprite and the resolution of another sprite, they ain't even the same sport. Like they're totally different. So like the giant skeletons are a great example. They are the same sprite as the smaller skeletons scaled up, which means all of their pixels are like doubled or tripled. So now a thin black line is a big old thick black line, right? And because the other sprites might have like little thin black lines, or some of them don't have black outlines at all, which is, I'm not complaining about that, but like when there's a gigantic thick black outline and then this other sprite doesn't even have a black outline, like you notice it. And then the backgrounds are typically rendered at a way higher resolution than the sprites are. So when you look at like the castle, or you look at some of like the fire effects and things, there's this massive discrepancy where the castle, because it's stationary, has a lot more kind of like TLC poured into it and a much higher level of detail in a denser pixel ratio. And then like the flame effect is like 4 pixels, and it like, it doesn't look bad, but it just is a totally different amount of information used to convey this is fire versus this is a brick in the wall. And I just like, I don't think it's a bad thing, but like I couldn't stop noticing it. Cause at first I was just like, why does everything seem like it's outlined in Sharpie? No. Why do some things feel like they're outlined in Sharpie? Wait, why do only huge things feel like they're outlined in Sharpie? And then like, once I kind of put it together, I was like, oh, that's a thing you couldn't really do in the old days. Like you couldn't mix and match pixel densities quite this way. And it's just, it immediately gives it away as a new game using a classic art style, which again, this isn't a critique so much as like just a personal opinion.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and as we've kind of mentioned before, is that, you know, the idea is I think that that's in line with what we've seen with other nostalgia done right games, where it's like, you know, the huge skeletons not being rezzed the same as, you know, like the normal skeletons, like them just blowing them up, that I noticed that. And honestly, I just, you see them infrequently enough that it didn't really grind on me. But having a higher resolution for some other things that like would have been beyond impossible, you know, is I think mostly because, I mean, literally, I know these two guys who have an entire podcast on, does this hold up to your rose colored, you know, glasses, right? So I think that's the thing, is that, you know, the game makers anticipate the fact that like you're remembering Mega Man being way more beautiful than it actually was, you know? So they're just putting that extra like, but if they did that additional like resolution, that additional like TLC on the pixel art like characters that you're focused on, you'd be like, well, this isn't a nostalgic game at all. It doesn't have that nostalgic art style. But if they do it in the background, then it just feeds your brain like, look at how beautiful this looks. It doesn't look bad, you know, like they're able to do things like that to immerse you in it the way you remember being immersed in it, without actually taking it to the point where you're like, no, this is no longer, this is clearly impossible. It bends what your, it is doing things that are impossible, but it bends what your mind thinks is possible. It doesn't shatter it. It doesn't break it.
Yeah, you know? you end up with an illusion as opposed to a failed magic trick, right? Because a failed magic trick where like the guy drowns, or the you see him, you know, have the key in his cheek and that's how he picks the handcuffs, like that's unspectacular and not funny and is just sad. But like a successful illusion, like even if you are aware that you have been tricked, like to steal a line from the Fantastic Prestige, like you want to be fooled. Like, you want to remember those old games as being as amazing as they sometimes were, but often were not.
One of the visual things that they did, as far as like visuals in service of gameplay, that I was really impressed with was...
Is it the ridiculous walk the knight has? Because I super love that.
Okay, well, that was visual for the sake of visual, and I did love that, man. I just love how he's just like, he is just gung-ho. Like they are just into it, you know? Like, I'm going to go storm the castle, and it was amazing. Especially, what really threw me with that was the spell sword.
Who doesn't have a sword.
Yeah, it doesn't have a sword until they swing, you know? So it's just kind of like, I saw that, I was like, man, they're having a blast, man.
Committed to the bit.
No, it was what they did with off-screen projectiles visually. I thought they handled
the little like heads-up bubble.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I thought that was like handled very, very well, because like, especially, you know, for some of the projectiles, they are moving too quickly for you to react to them the moment they come on the screen. You have to know that this is coming for you. So it's called out visually in a way that there's no mistaking that it is not on the screen, you know. Mm-hmm. like it's very clearly, like, you know, it's on the periphery. It's a little like you said, like a HUD bubble.
Yeah, it's like it's like a tool tip, like, go over here to get to the next town.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it comes down, but then, like, you know, right when it enters the screen, that disappears and you see the actual projectile. But the fact that they called that out to you, and again, and we'll get into this more mechanics, but Rogue Legacy, it follows its own rules, you know, like pretty hardcore. So, you know, if there's an enemy that you can damage that enemy. If you get the gigantic person and you can smash through a wall, if you can get your sword to hit that enemy, you can damage them, you know, like, those are the rules, you know? So the fact that, you know, that they were so consistent with that visual, you know, like, really was able to feed me information. So that way I could make, I never felt like just something came out of nowhere. Cause we played nostalgic game, but older games with that were like, something comes in from off screen and nails you. And you're like, I didn't know that existed until it was too late for me to do anything about it. That never happens. If you get hit, it's your fault.
Yeah. And they only do it with projectiles because I think projectiles can move there's little flaming skull guys, right? And they shoot the little white like balls. Those projectiles do not get the little off-screen marker because their projectiles are moving slow enough that if it comes onto the screen, you have time to respond. But then there's like the little turrets, and there's the skeletons that throw an infinite number of femurs. Those projectiles,
you know, they're bones and fall out.
Exactly. Those projectiles move way faster than you could possibly respond if you didn't know that it was coming. So you get that tooltip. So not only are they consistent about it, but they are consistent. You need to know about this tooltip because there's about to be no tooltip and you're about to die. Whereas with the slower ones, they don't also have the tooltip there, because that would almost be, that would like trick you, because you would like jump or dodge too early. And then when you landed like an idiot, the thing would have, you know, slowly plotted its way over to you and bonked you. And you'd be like, God damn it.
But yeah, I thought that was a very, very necessary visual, especially because like in a roguelike, which are known for being unforgiving, not punishing, but unforgiving, you know, where it's just kind of like, if you, cause and this is straying in the mechanics a little bit, but I remember when I, you know, like kind of walked in the first time, having just played Celeste a lot, where death is, and I mean, death isn't punished in this game either, but you know, where like I walked in and I took some damage. I was like, okay, wait, health drops are few and far between. And I only have some, every hit counts. Huh? You know, and that's the thing, is that every hit like changes the way that you're like calculating and viewing. So because of that, they can't ever hit you unfairly, you know?
Right.
Like when I would go running into, like there would be sometimes where I would run in, like I would go guns blazing into an area and just straight up run into somebody. And you could make the argument that I was running in so quickly that like, because everything moves relative to you, that the speed at which they entered the frame was faster than I could have reasonably reacted to it. But I did that to me. Like I went in, you know, like all crazy and like, oh, I've got this, you know? So it felt fair. And I felt that the visuals did that. What did you think of the hitbox?
Okay, so I will answer that question in a minute, but the comment you just made made me realize something that actually didn't show up in my notes. But the minute you said that, I was just like, wait, that did piss me off, which is because every hit counts and you need to be like kind of referencing your health. I don't feel like the HUD is designed all that great. And this is a visual that you really super need, right? You really super need to know how many hit points you currently have, how much MP you currently have, and the bar, because it's, I kind of don't love this visual style, but it's a bar with a number over it. So you can just quickly reference the size of the bar and say like, oh, I have 80% of my green bar filled, or you can look at the number and see that it's, you know, 400 out of 500 hit points, right? That checks out. Yes. So like if it was bigger, or if like it noticeably changed more, because different classes have tremendously different amounts of hit points. And there would be times where I would look up in the corner and I was like, oh dear God, this person only has like 120 hit points. And the person I'd been playing 2 seconds ago had like 300 or 400 hit points. And it's like, the bar is bigger for the person who has twice as many hit points, but it sure as hell isn't twice as big. So like you don't have this super quick visual reference. And what I ended up doing was squinting at the number a lot and just trying to read the actual number underneath the bar. So that was something that like I found was a little acting against me, because I agree with you. Mechanically, you really super care if you are taking damage, how much damage you're taking, how fast you're taking it, how soon you're going to stop taking damage. And the way you decide how you're going to handle this situation that is killing you is going to be really different if you are hours from death, minutes from death, seconds from death. Like, and the HP bar just didn't feel like it gave me enough information to either be able to glance at it super quickly or just always feel like it was in my periphery. Like I had to look at it.
Yeah, I definitely agree to you for you that there is a cost of entry to assess your hit points. I mean, like, you know, it's not like you have to, get on a flight to California and, you know, like sit in a meeting and then, you know, like query your hit points. I mean, like it is just a glance, but I mean, that is meaningful in a video game. So there is a high cost of entry to that. Like, for this one, it didn't bother me, and I'm trying to think as to why. And what I'm basically coming up with is the fact that it's kind of supposed to be like, you could make the argument, it could just be that it wasn't thought out, but like you could make the argument that it's kind of supposed to be, because like you don't always know what your hit points are, you know. So the idea is that like, you know, there's that additional like stress and fear that like when I was in the middle of, you know, the mess where like everything's firing the million projectiles and everybody's everywhere and you're ducking, weaving and dodging, the fact that I did not inherently know my hit points made it not a math problem, you know. Like, to me, that kind of pulled me a little bit more into the experience, because I'm not running calculations in my head of how, like you just said, like how much damage am I taking, how long am I going to be taking it, like all that sort of stuff. It's like no, I can't get hit at all because I don't even really know what my hit points are at this point, you know.
Yeah, and I get it's possible, because I think you may be a slightly better player at this style of game than I am.
And I wouldn't say that. Judging by our death tallies.
Well, I mean, a lot of those were your son, which I think is super appropriate. But I think you may have a slight edge on me, and because I felt like I was struggling a lot early in the game. Like when I would be in a situation where there was just crap flying everywhere and it was very bullet helly, like I felt a tremendous sense of being overwhelmed, which, I mean, in the designer's defense, is exactly how they wanted me to feel. So they accomplished their goal, but I felt like I don't even have the option to have my HUD in front of me in a way that I feel like I'm getting constant updates. It's like I can ping that information occasionally, and I don't get to decide that schedule, because depending on how much crap is on the screen decides how occasionally I can look at the HUD. So Again, like, this isn't really a critique of the design, because I think that is an intentional design choice, as you're suggesting. I just don't like it.
which is fair. Because to me, like, there were a couple of times when I got that projection into the experience, you know, that I really enjoyed, which, like, you know, at one point I think I was using the knives, right? And so I was just, I threw a knife, jump, hit, threw a knife. And then I went to throw a knife and I duffed it because I'd blown through all of my MP, you know? And so arguably that's a bad thing, right? Like, I made a decision without, you know, like, I made the wrong decision because I didn't have all the information that I needed to make it. But to me, like, I was sitting there, you know, just dropping bad guys left and right in this, like, huge tower, like huge tower that was, everything was against me. And then I just, like, reached, like, Indiana Jones style, reached for the gun, and it wasn't there, you know? And then I was like, crap. And then I, like, had to double back and, like, you know, like, double jump and back off and, like, kind of gain some distance, because I was like, oh, God, you know, like, I've got to rethink my strategy now because I'm out of magic. And this relates, this is more of a mechanics thing, but it does relate to what you're talking about. We'll get into it way more, but each of the characters have, like, abilities, you know, like traits, yeah, right?
Each of the classes.
Each of the classes have traits, but, like the traits can be independent of the class.
Oh, you mean like the upside down guy and, like, yeah, nostalgic, where everything's all grainy, those traits.
One of them is you feel no pain. I forget, because they always gave, like, the actual, like, name of it, you know, the clinical definition.
Yeah,
you know?
And then the explanation is often, frequently, almost always useless. And they want you to discover through gameplay what they mean, which, again, I think is totally on brand. But
yeah,
go
exactly.
on.
One of them was you don't feel pain. And did you ever play a character with that trait?
Yes, but I think that was on my list of ones that I wasn't confident I knew what the effect was.
It you can't see what your hit points are at all.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah. No, like, your hit, it's just empty. Like, it just, you don't know. And that was, like, the awesome thing, because when I was deciding my progeny, I would think long and hard, because if I was like, man, they've got the class that I want, you know, like, they're gigantic. So, I mean, like, I like that. Oh, no, they can't feel pain. That's going to be rough, you know, and I'd really think hard about it. So, you know, like, the fact that they actually take that visual completely away from you at some points to be like, hey, man, you want all this good stuff. This person doesn't feel pain. And I like that. That's, like, a negative, because it is, you know, like, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, man, I wish I didn't feel pain at all. And it's just kind of like, no, actually, that's a horrible crippling problem, because pain is your friend, your ally. It will let you know when you have become seriously injured. You know?
Like, no, you don't wish you couldn't feel pain. You wish you couldn't be hurt.
Yeah. So, you wish that you were invulnerable, yes, not that you couldn't feel pain. Which is different things. But yeah, so that didn't really bug me quite as much. But what did you think of the hitbox?
So I was genuinely surprised by the hitbox in this game, because it is a rogue light, right? But it still uses a lot of randomization, procedural generation, right? Like, each of these screens is not lovingly handcrafted. Like, there's a lot of math that just makes random nonsense happen, right? Mm-hmm. And they do a good job of the math that makes random nonsense happen. And the best example of that I can possibly give is you have on your helmet a little plume thing, you know, like a little, like, the red, like, thing. And that is not within your hitbox. So if something passes through the little red plume thing, which is really close to your head, it doesn't stand up like a centurion. It hangs down like a medieval knight. So if something passes through that, you do not take damage. And I am positive of that, because it seems like they made an intentional design choice that whenever they randomize, like, a dip, so, like, you walk into a room and there's, like, a drop down and a drop down, like, steps down, that those are always certain heights, and, or they're almost always certain heights. And they are visually very distinct from the other possible heights. So it's either giant and you obviously have to jump, it's about your height and you don't have to jump, or it's very small. And since you can't duck in this game, it doesn't provide you any cover. And the reason I noticed this is because there's a like a floating spike ball trap that's just like randomly all over the damn place. And anytime you are standing on one of those medium-sized dips, that little floating spike ball, if it's on the next step up, will pass effectively through what looks like your head. And
yes.
And you can just stand there and let it just go back and forth right through your skull, ripping out chunks of your brain, but somehow not hurting you. And
yes.
That made me realize, like, oh, the hitbox is intentionally smaller than my character sprite by like a considerable margin. And I think the opposite is happening with your strike zone. When you swing your sword, it seems to be pretty friggin' generous on what it counts as a hit.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely think that the game, again, you know, like it, they, if you get hit, it's your fault, right? A hitbox, you didn't, you know, not know where your character avatar is. If you get hit, it's on you, you know? The weird thing was, because I noticed that too, you know, and I don't know why, because normally I would classify that as like a sloppy hitbox, you know, where it's just like, no, I need to know what my hitbox is. I need to know why I'm being hit. But it was just like, because I noticed it in the exact same way with the spiky ball going through your head. And I was just kind of like, that's odd. But then if you even hop up just the tiniest amount, like it will then register the hit, you know, but it was just, I don't know like why they did, but it felt so consistent, you know?
It did.
That, like I could rely on it, you know? It's like, I know I've got this little bit of extra give, you know? So,
well, it felt
so I could
very,
capitalize on it.
This feels like a place where the visuals are benefiting from the modernity of the platform, because things can move essentially on the entire coordinate plane, right? So it's 2D platformer, and anything can come at you in basically any direction. Now, eventually you see all of the directions that happen, but there are some instances, you know, there's like the turret enemies always fire straight, except the ones that are heat-seeking, and like the archers always fire at like kind of the same arc, except for the ones that fire two arrows. So like you kind of learn like, oh, this enemy sort of moves and behaves in this way. But there's like a lot of enemies that do magic. There's a lot of things that are like large, and there's just a lot of times where there's just a ton of crap on the screen. So when you are barely evading your pursuers, the fact that something may have like technically passed through the top of your sprite, I don't think it's their way of being sloppy. I think it's their way of saying like, we didn't want to make the sprite smaller, but you cannot have this gigantic hitbox. You would be getting clocked constantly. So like to shave even just a few pixels off the top and maybe the sides, I don't know about size, but definitely off the top of the hitbox, is just their way of being like, yeah, because this is like disproportionately more fun for this tiny reduction in realism that you will only notice with the slow moving spike trap. You will never ever notice it in the heat of battle because there's just too much crap going on.
Yeah, exactly. Now I think that I think that you're right. Is that what it does is it creates, as opposed to like when there's a billion things on the screen and you just feeling like you're being pummeled, it makes you feel like you're just super clever and super adept at, you know, like ducking and weaving and dodging and like, oh man, I just barely got out of there. That's the way it feels. Like it's maximizing for game feel, you know, like that particular visual, not for actual realism, because otherwise you just like, dude, I mean, even with the amount of give that game had, there were some rooms where I would walk into it and go, nope, and just walk right back out, you know, where I was like, nope, that's this is beyond my skill set or my like character level, you know, like I'm like, can't, nope, we're good. But there would be a lot more rooms like that if the hitbox wasn't generous in that way. But
for sure. I do want to ask you, because I had a realization, because this game is really the core thing you're trying to do is explore. The core aesthetic is, I would say, first exploration and then close second is challenge, right? So it has a lot of like bullet hell components where there's just sometimes a ton of crap on the screen, and some enemies generate enemies. So if you are reckless, you can allow that to really get overwhelming where there's just an unacceptable amount of nonsense happening. Because you go from like the castle to the forest, to the Maya, to the Underdark, what's the bottom place called? The Underdark.
I just always kept calling it. It's not the, but I kept calling it hell because I just, it's hell.
It is hell.
You know, I think it's the dungeon. Isn't it the dungeon?
Maybe. Yeah, it might be the dungeon. But like each of those areas has some enemies in common, and there's a lot of palette swapping going on. Even within a given area, there's palette swapping going on. And it wasn't bothering me, and I was trying to figure out why. And I realized, I think it's because there's this very strong bullet hell kind of like twitch reflex challenge design in this game. And palette swapping gives you a lot of information quickly because
I agree.
When you see a yellow, the
wizard.
Yeah, the wizard. You see the fire wizard, and then you see the blue wizard, and you're like, I know kind of what his deal's going to be, and he moves in the same sort of way, and his tell is the same. This game reminds you constantly, like, you need to learn their tells. It matters, right? So, like, they all have the same tells if they're within, like, the same class or family or whatever. And I thought that was, like, this is palette swapping for good. Like, they need a way to quickly convey information to me. And palette swapping is a way that they can say, hey, this looks like another thing you've dealt with. So some of that information will be useful, but not all of it. And now what you end up with is like a family of, let's say, like four different enemies that are all, they all have certain things in common and they all have small differences. So now you only have to memorize the small differences. So like yellow does this, blue does that, green does whatever, because it's way easier to just have automatically memorized the commonalities. And I was like, oh my God, this is like righteous palette swapping. Like this is, this is when you do palette swapping, and it doesn't seem lazy because this is intentional and in a lot of ways necessary. If they had 300 unique enemies, committing all of that to memory would be impossible or just not fun.
Right. No, it would be nightmarish. And I think that you're right that this is palette swapping used as a tool for like gameplay, for gameplay purposes, not as a tool to reduce cost, you know, which is where you see it used a lot. Because and to me it actually added to the feeling of tension a little bit, because okay, so when you would walk into like you said, like let's take the 300 different monsters versus the whatever 20 that there actually are, right? When I would walk into a room and see if I saw a brand new enemy, which definitely happens, you know, like in each area there, they introduce like one or two new baddies, you know?
Oh yeah. There's no shortage of enemies there, but they're grouped into families.
Right. So when I go and see an actual new enemy, like I would stop, you know, and be like, this is a huge unknown, you know? Like, whereas most areas, when you walk in, you see stuff that you've kind of seen before. So like you said, like you can kind of be like, okay, well, this is going to do some stuff like this. And then, so it would create like some hesitation, but it wouldn't bring you to like a halt, like a new enemy would. So if every time you entered a new area, there was like a new, like 30 new enemies, the pacing would be way slower. Whereas like with the wizards, you know, I particularly enjoyed them because, you know, you see the first one, there's the ice wizard and the fire wizard. And you're like, all right, cool. You know, the fire wizard fires little fireballs. The ice wizard does his little like icicle thing. And then you see the green wizard for the first time. You're like, that's new. So like you said, he moves the same way. So you don't have to memorize like a new movement pattern or anything like that. And you know that he's going to cast some kind of a spell. And when he does it, he puts his finger up and it's like, oh, a little thing appeared. Oh, God, a thing appeared right underneath me. You like hammer the X and you're like, I gotta go, you know. And that's a fun little enjoyable thing. Or then when you see like a big one, you're like, okay, this guy is bigger. So typically bigger means more powerful. All right. And then he does like the ice spell and you're like, okay, oh my God, there's a billion icicles. And so, you know, like it really, like you said, I think it hit the nail on the head where it gives you, they're very careful with the amount of cognitive load they're placing on you, you know, especially when, I think that they put it in the, you know, domain of pacing of the game, being like, for every new person, like a brand new enemy causes this type of delay in the player, whereas a palette swapped enemy causes this type of delay in the player, you know, speed. So it's like, how fast do we want them chewing through this? You know, like I think, and this is kind of in general, that they did a great job balancing making the player uneasy, but not making them terrified, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, it feels constantly challenging and interesting and often frustrating, but it never feels scary. It never feels like emotionally burdensome, right? And that's, I think, making something be frustrating without making you like smash your controller is a certain kind of challenge, but it is easy to overwhelm a person by just throwing huge amounts of flashing and conflicting information at them to where you could start to feel like a minor but real amount of like kind of dread. And you never yeah. really feel that way. Like it always feels like, ah, damn it. Like, don't do this to me. Don't make all these wizards be on screen at the same time. Right. But you never, it's never scary. It's never like foreboding.
Well, and the thing is that, you know, you generally know what you need to do. Like if all of a sudden, you know, there's, you know, 15 wizards on the screen, you see it and your brain assesses it and says like, okay, this is what I need to do. Like I should draw them out, or I'm just going to go in guns blazing. You have, again, the information that you need to start assessing the problem and coming up with countermeasures. And so then they drop in those little palette swapped unknowns, new enemies as like new unknowns, like create like a small amount of like, oh, this is new and different and you're exploring, so it's interesting, right? You know, and then they would occasionally throw in a brand new enemy type to be like, okay, wait, what does this do all together?
Well, and the size, which you mentioned, is they're not a little bigger. The bigger ones are like impossible to not notice bigger. So if yes. when you fight the big wizard or the huge wizard, it's a really obvious, like, normal, large, extra large. So you don't look at it and be like, oh, is that the big one? Oh, God, it is the big one. Like, you know.
Yeah. One other, the final thing that I have for visuals, and this is a minor thing, not like an overarching thing, but I really felt added to the tension of the game was the Doom bosses enemy type. I don't know why that name stood out to me, but they are the paintings.
Oh, sorry. You put a different emphasis on that syllable. I was pronouncing it Doomfus.
Oh, Doomfus.
Like canvas.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but yes, the Doomfus and the Doomtrit, and then there's the third level. I can't remember the name of it. They all had cute pun names.
Yeah.
But yeah, they the way they look and then also sound is alarming.
Yeah. The way they look is, and that's a good segue into sound. But I thought the but I'm gonna crap all over it. I thought that was a good enemy type because there are portraits everywhere, you know. And then later on, there are mimics as well. And I know that mimics are like everyone's favorite enemy type. Like, you know, that is just, oh God, I love. I mean, I don't know. As a DM, I love mimics so much, especially when you. Like when somebody says like, oh, I really like mimics or I really dislike mimics, right? Then you just always make sure to describe the treasure chest to them. You know, be like, oh, well, there's this, that, and the third thing. And there's a treasure chest. And it's like, is it a treasure chest? And just 98% of the time it is.
So can I have a side thing to your side thing. Have you ever heard of another term for a mimic besides mimics?
Mm-mm, I don't think so.
Okay. So I was, one of our listeners asked like, oh, what's coming up? And I was like, oh, I'll give you a little inside scoop. Like, this is the game we're playing for the next episode. And they were like, oh, that's cool. And then they were like watching some gameplay and they're like, oh, in this one, you know, area in the, is it the Maya? I think we're there. Like, oh, yeah. In the Maya, there's friggin' monster chests. That's crap. And I was like, do you mean mimics? And they were like, yeah, monster chest. And I was like, mimics. Like they're called mimics. And then I sort of had this like moment of existential dread where I was like, do I only think that that's their name because of D&D? Like, is there some other nerd thing where they've always been called monster chests and I just never knew that?
I mean, quite possibly. It could be in like just some other popular RPG. They just called them monster chests. And it was just maybe because like, It probably because if I had to guess, it'd be a JRPG, you know, where it's just like it directly translates to monster chess.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And that's not a bad theory. But I stand by, they are mimics. They've always been mimics. They will always be mimics, and only your fleas will mourn you. No, wait, that doesn't work.
but I really like the use of, particularly of the Doombas, because it does like an insane person, I was swinging at almost every portrait, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, you go a little mad once you realize some of them are evil, because it's a Skinner box, right? There's way more portraits than Doomvis is, but some of them are Doomvis.
Yeah, some of them definitely are. So, again, and they use them judiciously, you know? Like, it's not like every room has, like, 5 or 10 portraits in it, you know, that could be. But, like, literally, when I'd see that, it would slow me down, you know? And then I'd be like, oh, no, that wasn't one. And then eventually I kind of started getting halfway good at being like, this one is probably one because of where it's placed, you know, so I'm likely to come in contact with it. But sometimes I was just wrong, man, you know.
I just made jumping and swinging part of my normal movement style. So, like, as I am just moving through the room, jumping and swinging at every portrait, just like the same way you would jump and swing at all the chandeliers to try and get money, like, that just became part of my life. So, so to the casual observer, they would be like, man, that guy sure hates paintings.
Well, and that was the thing, is that, like, to me, you know, if all of a sudden, like, I had a ward going with me on the adventure or something like that, or even just, like, another human sitting down next to me to play and be like, why do you keep swinging at those paintings? Because some of them move. And it's like, what? No, some of them are monsters. There are monsters in the paintings. There are. No, I'm not crazy. You're crazy. Like that. It really does kind of make you kind of embody that the insanity that would be wearing on your character going through this horrible dungeon that their parents and their parents' parents and their parents' parents' parents all perished in.
Begat, begat, begat. Okay, so now we can do audio.
Now audio. I really, really liked the audio in this. I enjoyed all of the music. It was all, I felt like each of the different areas, they all have like their own little, you know, song, whatever. And it's all very fitting. The one thing I do want to call out just off top is the special room with the jukebox in it.
That was pretty neat.
I liked that a lot.
Yeah.
You know? Because, like, it was just nice because, you know, sometimes you spend a lot of time in a certain area. So it's just nice once in a while to be like, oh, get to listen to some different jams. And I would always make it some of the boss music because the boss music was awesome.
Yeah, I don't know if that is a well-established thing in certain video game genres or maybe on certain, like, maybe on PC it's super common for people to, like, have iTunes open or Winamp while they're also gaming. So, like, it became a cultural thing. For me, that is entirely a Metal Gear Solid thing. Because starting in, I want to say 3, it's been a little while. But in one of the middle Metal Gear Solids, you can just unlock music. And then your character literally puts headphones in and you can like scroll through an iPod and like select friggin' music you want to listen to while you're playing. So there's like the normal ambient music, which is sometimes very subtle and sometimes like really over the top, like crazy orchestra. But you can just choose to listen to not even just other music from the game. In Metal Gear Solid, like it's an iPod. So he has like 80s jams and like, and like hip hop from the 90s. I mean, just like music, like just regular old music, like, and not like covers, like they actually licensed real music. So I don't know if the jukebox thing is because they're aware there's kind of only 4 songs and you're going to kind of hear them a lot. I don't know if it's an homage to Metal Gear Solid or some other genre, the same way the game as a whole is like an homage to Rogue. But it's a fantastic inclusion. Like sometimes you are like, okay, I've heard this song enough.
Yeah. Or kind of like with Fallout with the, you know, Pip-Boy,
how you the can, radio. Like, turn on. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and how many feats do you get with each level in Fallout 3? Can you remind me on that?
Dude, why do you even bother showing up stuff like this?
So for side story for those of our listeners who don't know this, Lyons and I one time were driving in a car and I was just playing Fallout 3 and he, because Lyons introduced me to Fallout 3 or Fallout the series in general, And I said, you know, hey, you know, you get a feat every level in Fallout 3, you know, as opposed to every other level in New Vegas, which I didn't care for. And Lion's like, you only get a feat every other level in Fallout 3. I'm like, no, it's every level. And we slap bet over it.
And
what I really appreciated the most was we were in the car. So you immediately set to looking it up because you were confident that you were correct. And so you just looked up and said, well, try not to knock my teeth out when you slap me.
I mean, you know, I made my bed. I laid in it.
Yep. No, very, very nice of that. But anyways, so I did think that was a great inclusion. I thought that overall the music was very fitting. Like I said, like for each different area. I know that your ears are typically more honed than mine.
Well, so there is something, and I know we talked about this when we played Celeste, and I've noticed this in other new but classic style games I've played. This often happens where in the visuals, for some reason, I'm aware of the artistic things that are happening in a more judgy, preachy way. Whereas with the music, when they stop using strictly chiptune instruments and they use like actual instruments or they use other kinds of synthesizers and things that could have never happened on like a classic console, like I notice it, I definitely notice it, and I like almost am never bothered by it because I feel something about the pixel art aesthetic is like, you are setting yourself a standard as an artist, right? And then, but with the music, I just don't feel like they're obligated to be as true to the chiptune for some reason. And as a person who listens to chiptune, like in my free time, like I just enjoy that genre of music. I hear a lot of music that mixes modern and classic chiptune instruments. So maybe I've just developed a taste for it and it doesn't stand out to me as much, but this game does that a lot. There's a lot of really obvious, very true to form classic chip style instrumentation, but then there's just like strings and like other synthesizers and like totally modern normal things, and they do it really well. It's all good, catchy music. It's all like very thematic since each of the four areas is like super different in its theming. Yeah, so I just like I enjoy it, all of that music, but like this is another thing, just like the different scaling in the art, but for some reason it doesn't bother me.
One of the other things I noticed with the sound effects in particular was that if an enemy does a thing, like just with like the visuals off screen, there's that you know, little box that shows you, you know, that the projectile is coming at you. It will make a sound as well. Like the enemies make a sound when they do a thing, whatever that thing is, you know?
And kind of whatever distance, as long as they're in the same room.
Right, exactly. So if they're in the same room, if you're going to have to deal with it, it makes the sound. It gives you all of the information, which is good because, you know, you're being fed a lot of information. So they're giving your brain as many hooks as they possibly can, you know? So there were definitely times where I would hear, you know, the skeleton making the, you know, like
bone jangling noise. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just kind of like, oh, okay. You know, it's just, it's a good way to leverage the sound to, you know, give you information. And they also do it as well with, like when you hit stuff, you know, is that when you swing on something that you can't interact with, it makes a whiff sound. When you hit something, it makes like kind of a meaty thwap sound. And if you hit something where it's like a shield or where you're not hitting it correctly, it will make like a gong sound, you know?
Yeah. And I don't need things that are squishy to make an I hit something squishy noise. I don't need enemies that are armored to make an I hit something armor noise. I don't need the wizards to make a sword hitting cloth noise. I need to know when I hurt them, but not as much as I could have hurt them, and when I didn't hurt them at all. Like those are, right, especially in a game with like bullet hell style combat elements. I need that audio cue. I need it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that, and also too, they have a specific sound for when you done killed it. You know, it goes like that, like poof. Yeah, you know,
poof. What do you need?
Yeah.
Poof. What do you need?
Yeah, except that Genie's not dying every time that he does that.
Nah, just once.
Well, I think with every wish that he granted, he died a little inside. But moving on. But no, so again, like it's relaying that information that, you know. Yes, you hit it, you damaged it, and you hit it and killed it. you know, because they do have the health bar at the top. But again, that's not something that you can reference regularly.
It is not quick reference. It's basically there for bosses. And so you can see the funny names that all the monsters have.
Yeah, there's all that. And also, too, like, sometimes if I was going mano a mano against the bad guy, because it's, and we can get into this more mechanics, but, you know, generally the amount of damage that you're doing, like, is it's quantized, right? Like, enemies typically take 1, 2, or 3 hits, you know? It's just so, like, whenever you would get that one additional upgrade that now made this enemy a one-hit enemy as opposed to a two-hit enemy, like, that was a big deal.
Oh, yes.
You know, but sometimes I would take a swing at a thing and then, like, look up and then just mentally register. Because, again, just remembering 1, 2, or 3 hits with this at this level, that's pretty easy to remember. So, you know, just remembering, like, this bad guy, this enemy type takes 2 hits, you know, like, or what have you. And it's also nice, too, is like you said, like with bosses or even the mini bosses, when you're wailing away on them, like, you can then check the bar to be like, how much longer am I going to have to sustain this level of activity? Because I am swinging for the fences and doing everything I can. And, oh, I've done 10% damage. This is where this person's story ends.
Yep. It was good knowing you, Sir Jonas the 18th. So I do have to mention, if I didn't, you probably would have, that it makes an armor clanking noise when you walk because you are heavily clad in full plate mail. And I actually distinctively asked myself, why am I not irritated by this? Because if you, so like, we'll get to like how well I played this, but the TLDR is like, I got stuck for a while where I spent a lot of time like completely clearing entire areas before going on to the next area and attempting to completely clear it because I was just trying to collect as much gold as possible. And
right.
When you are doing a lot of backtracking, you do a lot of just walking. And because the enemies don't respawn, which I think is the right decision for this game style.
Yes.
So you are backtracking, and if you're just walking down an empty room with no monsters or anything in it, you just hear clank, 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 clank. And I was like, why am I not annoyed by that? And it's obvious, because you don't actually do that very often. You almost never just walk down an uninhabited hallway completely unhindered. And if you did, you would probably be dashing or double jumping because you're bored. And then the rest of the time, there's crap going on constantly. And you're not just walking in a straight line. You're jumping, you're dodging, you're weaving, you're dashing, you're double jumping, you're triple jumping, you're using your sword to like bounce off the little green platform thing. So you don't often hear long, continuous, uninterrupted stretches of the metal clanking walking noise. And I was like, oh, so that's a good consideration. Like, should I have this hyper repetitive noise? Yes. If the circumstances under which it would be hyper repetitive are very rare and easy to deal with, because if you're walking down a long unobstructed hallway with no enemies, you can just jump or dash and then you don't have to hear the noise at all. And it can't become annoying. So I was like, you know, did they put as much thought into this as I'm putting into this right now? Probably not. But it's just a side effect of no single noise other than the damage noise and the sword swing noise is likely to become hyper repetitive. And those noises are quite pleasant to hear because you're hitting things and then they die.
Yes, exactly. And also, I think that like kind of like what you said, which is that like that noise basically drops out, you know, when you're just running, jumping, fighting, all that sort of stuff, like you don't even notice it. So, and it does just add that little bit of realism as opposed to your favorite game, Donkey Kong, right?
That's not realistic.
Where like that, where like the Mario walking noise is so loud, you know, it's loud, it's abrasive, and it's all the time, you know, like it is louder than a lot of the other sound effects are.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas
no,
this thing
it is still vibrating my teeth months later.
It vibrates through time. But yeah, so you have anything else for sound, or you want to move on to mechanics?
Yeah, I think we could move on to the controls and mechanics. And I do have, like I've had a few times recently, a specific mechanical note I need to call out, which is, or a control note rather, which is, so you were playing this on a PS4, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that is, as a PlayStation person, The PlayStation controller and the PS4 controller specifically, I think, is the best video game controller. Now, the Xbox One Pro controller is really, really dope. That is an excellent controller. But I'm just more used to the Sony controller, and their legacy of controller design has been a lot better. So I've never been a big PC gamer, but there are certain games that I play on PC for personal reasons. And when I do, I'm usually using a cheap Xbox 360 controller that I got. The Xbox 360 controller has a notoriously garbage D-pad. I mean, a cartoonishly, unbelievably bad D-pad. And I have never been a person who can play a 2D game with the thumbstick, even though they totally allow you to do that. And even though it is kind of appropriate because you can sort of move in all directions, I cannot navigate a 2D platformer with a thumbstick. I have to use the D-pad, and the D-pad on this controller sucks. It sucks so bad. And I know this is like very 10-year-old to blame the controller, but I definitely friggin' died because of this controller. Like at least a handful of deaths I can directly attribute to the controller, because some of them were very unspectacular. Like I went to do the little down slash to open up the little platform and it didn't happen, and I just fell to my death on some spikes, and I was like, cool, thanks Microsoft. Yeah, that was great. Cool.
When I actually have a note about the controls, which to me, using the Sony one, it was they were very seamless. And again, like, so to juxtapose it to, like, let's say, you know, Toy Story, right? I was always like, something, if ever I thought I can make that jump, I was right, you know?
Yes.
Like, there was never a time when I was like, I think I can hit this, or I think I can do this, where I was wrong, you know? Like, your jump height is incredibly high, and you're able to control it while you're jumping with like razor precision, you know, like everything. The game responds to you very quickly, because if you get hit, it's bad. Like it can be really, you know, like it's very unforgiving in that thing. So they're like, we're going to give you all of the cards that you can, you know, that you can have. And then, so that way, if you get hit or you take damage or you die, that was on you. So it wasn't like I should have been able to jump higher. It's like you jump like seven times your height. It's just
and I think the reason for that is the jumping controls are designed for making micro adjustments in flight to avoid an enemy or an enemy projectile. And that means when you're doing something as rudimentary as regular platforming, you're way over engineered for jumping over a small pit. Like it's just, you know, I mean, you've brought a bazooka to a knife fight. Like it's amazing. But that does make traversing the world feel very empowering, which I kind of like.
Oh yeah. No, I definitely like that. And I think that they kind of then tackle it on the back end, because what do? They put in roof spikes in a lot of areas, you know.
Yep.
So if you get too crazy with the, like, I can jump wherever I want, it's like, no, but be careful, because you know you've got to be precise with some of your jumps. Like there was a lot of them. I know I ran into this particular room a lot where it was like a room area and then a small little tunnel with like spikes on the top and spikes on the bottom, and then another little room area. So you had to like jump, either perfectly get your arc through or like jump up and then dash through and then fall down. Whereas like that was a nuance. Like, you know, you couldn't just hurdle yourself at it because you'd screw it up.
Yeah.
And that actually leads into my biggest note, the thing that I think this game did very, very well, which is tailoring the difficulty curve to both avatar strength and player skill, you know? So like, and we had talked briefly about this before, but basically, like, you know, there are levels in this game, you know, like your avatar becomes more powerful over time. You get more hit points, you do more damage, you get more armor, you get more abilities. Your avatar becomes more powerful. However, like, you know, when you go into, you know, the forest, or what's the forest? Is it the forest?
I think it's literally just the forest.
Yeah, the forest. When you go into the forest for the first time, not only is everything in there dealing like twice as much damage, you know, so your avatar has to be twice as powerful in order to, you know, take the same number of hits. the stuff that's coming at you, they're firing more projectiles. They're moving faster. They're moving in a more complicated pattern. You know, so you, the player, have to be more skilled to approach it. If you, the player, have not become more skilled, your avatar would have to become four times more powerful because you're going to be getting hit twice as often.
Yeah, by enemies hitting twice as hard.
Twice as much damage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was really clever and very well done. And the fact that they visually, because like you're in a new area, the visuals are completely different. Everything about this lets you know, like, this is a different ball game. So there were some times where, you know, like I would walk into, I'd just be like running around doing my thing. And all of a sudden I'd be like in the dungeon area. And I was like, nope, time to go. Because, and not even because like, I was like, my character is underpowered. They were, but I was like, I don't have the skills yet to deal with all of this nonsense, you know?
Yeah, agreed. And I don't think we called out enough in visuals, so I will just agree with you that each of the areas is impossible to confuse. They look 1,000% different from each other. They have totally different palettes. They have totally different designs. They have totally different theming. Like, that's a nice, again, like, you don't have to think about what area you're in and therefore what kinds of enemies you're going to encounter and what kinds of traps you're likely to encounter, because you can't forget, oh, I'm in the castle. Oh, now I'm in the Maya. Oh, now I'm in the forest. Like, oh, where was I again? No, you cannot possibly make that mistake, which is mechanically, I think, a really excellent use of the visuals. Because you might say like, oh, really? Only four areas? And it's like, yeah, how many of those do you really want to have to commit to memory?
Right.
And yeah, and no, this is absolutely something that I was a little shocked when I first started playing this game, because like I said, I bought it that same day we started talking about it, and I didn't understand immediately how roguelike the layout was. And so I'm like, this is a Metroidvania. Like, I gotta explore this castle, I got a map. Sometimes I can't like go into an area because I don't have the right thing. And that was what made me realize the important difference, because I was like, George doesn't really like Metroidvanias. Why is he so on board with this game? And that was what the oh, I can't complete this room reality is what made me understand it. Because if you enter the castle and you cannot complete a room, you cannot complete that room, period. You can't leave and go get the item you need and then re-enter the castle. You just cannot complete that room. End of story. And there are rooms that you can't do with like the runes you have equipped or whatever. Like if you're gigantic and you need to be a dwarf or whatever. So like, it took me, as someone who loves Metroidvania games and has played a lot of them, I died pretty spectacularly a few times in a room that I could not have possibly succeeded in. And it was just like, oh, right, because I had to do like a quadruple jump. Otherwise, I was going to fall onto spikes and die. And I know I can't do a quadruple jump. So what was I hoping to would happen? Right. And so like, once I kind of realized like, oh, that's it. You never encounter a room where you say, okay, I need to remember to go get the double jump boots and then come back here later, because that reality cannot happen except if you use the architect.
Correct. Yeah. Like if you're like, you know what, I do have the tools I need for this back at the base. So, you know, like I do want to get this room, approach this treasure, whatever. So I'm going to lock it down and do that. But then the cost associated with that is staggeringly high.
40%.
Yeah. So it's just kind of like, that has to be a deliberate decision, you know?
Yeah. You got to really want that fairy chest or whatever. Cause that, I felt like most of the time, the only times I used the architect when I was like, I'm going to go back and get that fairy chest.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I mean, that's real. Cause I mean, you wouldn't want to do it just because I think one time I did it because literally the first two rooms I went into had like, honestly, got treasure chests in them, and I did the quick ROI math, and I was like, yeah, this is probably worth it, you know. so we can't talk about this without talking about the different the way character generation works, you know, because like they force you to change your play style.
Oh yeah,
you
know?
And so even though and just the act. Okay, so there's two main things. Like you get three progeny to choose from, right? And so there's the class that they, well, actually, I guess there are really three main things that I weighed, at least. The class that they are, right? Their secondary, their magic ability, right? What magic ability they have, and their traits, like the nuanced stuff. And all of that made that decision so fascinating. Because there were some classes I just straight up never played. I was like, nope.
What was your favorite and most hated?
My favorite... Okay, so my favorite to play, I would probably say, was the Barbarian, just because I could be a little bit more careless, you know? The one that I got the most utility out of was by far the Hokage. Like,
they're legit.
Yeah, like far and away, because they just... Okay, and so, all right, this is... I swear this is game-related, but just come with me on a journey here for a second, right? So, okay. So the thing is, like, because the idea is like, oh, well, if you have more hit points, that's better, right? All having more hit points does, because I assume that you had some runes equipped that had like the vampire ability, right? They fed you hit points back.
Oh yeah, and then when I got the one that does magic or MP and HP, I was just like, yes,
exactly. So the idea is that you do have like an input, right? So you have an input and a burn rate when you're taking damage. All having a high number of hit points does. That's inventory, right?
Yeah.
So basically, all you're doing is you're saying I'm allowed to make bad decisions longer before I start making good decisions again, you know, like because all that really matters is your input versus your output, right? So, you know, like, it's just, so Hokage fit right into that, because like they have low hit points, but it's like all that means is that if I can screw up the same amount, I just can't screw up a lot at once, you know.
Well, and the thing about Hokage that I found changed my playstyle a lot is because they hit so hard. They hit so hard.
And they're fast.
Yeah. Which means you move through the world dealing with way more one-hit enemies. A lot of two-hit enemies for other classes are a one-hit enemy for the Hokage. So I found myself using them as an explorer class. Like when I was just like, oh, I'm just going to clear the castle and the forest and then get as far as I can in the tower just to collect money, because I was like, everything in the castle and in the forest will be a one hit enemy for the Hokage. So I can just like jump through the screen. And as long as my sword comes into contact with them, they die. And you move through the world very differently when you have that level of confidence that the obstruction will get out of your way.
that it will fall before your feet.
Yeah.
And the class that I straight up refused to play was the wizard, man.
The archmage?
Nope.
Or the mage. Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Whatever. That piece of human garbage. Yeah. No. not in my family. Okay. You're not gonna see any stupid spell slingers. None of my kids are gonna grow up slinging spells like on the side of the road.
But
you know,
but what about the spell sword?
Well, the spell sword's fine because there's sword in the name.
It's right there. It tells what it says on the tin.
Yeah, it's the spell sword. You know,
I like the spell sword quite a bit. I got a lot of use out of that class, but it does not come up often.
No, it doesn't. The lich was also pretty good.
Was so good.
Yeah, because you could like build up your hit points. Like lich with like a high vampire ability was pretty dope. But the thing that I really loved was that, like, I would sometimes see a class I like a Hokage, but then, you know, they had traits that were so devastating to where I would be like, I don't know if I could do this. So, like, and especially because, like you said, like, before, is that the descriptions are so obtuse where there were sometimes where I'm like, I don't even know what this means. I don't know if I can take a risk on it. And then sometimes they would give you, like, a visual with it, and you're like, I still don't know what this means. And then you'd find out. Like at the last possible minute, the ones that I thought were amazingly creative were, and there's just so many of them, was the confused one.
Yeah, where you fire spells backwards.
Yes, which was hilarious to me because like I literally was like, okay, and I just took my knife and like I threw it directly behind me and I was like, don't, and then just cut it. That one, the dementia, I think it was.
That was alarming. That like that one genuinely put me off my guard a little bit.
Yes, like that there were enemies that did not exist.
Yes,
you know. Ah, man.
Although there's a clever way they're generous, which is the enemy that does not exist is often an enemy that can't be where you are.
Right,
and it's still your brain is still like enemy, but if you get clever enough, you can be like, no, that enemy can't be here. That's my imaginary enemy friend.
Well, just as like, you know, you see, I don't know if this is true in real medicine, but like you've seen a lot of movies where it's like the way that you sometimes have to cope with that is learning the tells of the things that are real versus not real, which you, the player, end up doing, yeah. You know, where you're just kind of like, no, that's not real. That one's just in my head, and trying to explain that one to Teddy while he's playing around. Like, you can't hurt that one, buddy. That one's in your mind.
Teddy, I don't even see anything. What are you swinging at? What's happening here?
What's going on with that?
I had the Vertigo. I think it's called Vertigo, where the screen is just literally upside down. Instant deal breaker. I tried it once, and I just killed myself to not have to deal with that anymore. Which, if my life I actually lived like that, I think that'd be like justifiable suicide. Like, I was like, nope. Like, I'm not doing this. This isn't funny. This isn't cute. This immediately makes the game completely unfun. And so every time I would see it, like, if everything else about that, you know, child, that next generation was on point, but they had Vertigo, I was just like, no, sorry.
Deal with it. Colorblind, I thought was really interesting. You know, the fact that it just puts everything in grayscale.
And, you know, that is way more punishing in the tower and the Underdark than it is in the castle and the forest.
Yes, and more punishing than I would have thought in general, because they're like, oh, the screen's black and white. I'm like, that's not too bad. I can deal with that. But it does, because it takes all the color out of it, right? Like, it does make it a lot harder to see, like, projectiles coming at you. And I was like, that was kind of clever. What was another one? A lot of the vision ones I thought were interesting, like the nearsighted versus farsighted, you know?
Yeah, I found those to be interesting additions, because some of the traits are there to be more like cutesy interesting, not to be overwhelmingly positive or negative. And nearsighted and farsighted kind of felt like that. Like, if there was a progeny that was nearsighted or farsighted, but they had other things that I wanted, I was like, that's fine. I'll put up with this. And it did bite me a few times, but it didn't make me sink or swim in a broad sense, but it did have a small impact, which feels appropriate for nearsightedness and farsightedness.
Yeah, exactly. The one other one, there were two other ones I just thought were like kind of like fun and interesting, which was, I forget the name of it, but where you're afraid of chickens. So all of the chickens are alive and they run away from you.
Yeah. Yeah. That one took me a minute to put together. Also, the one where you don't have a foot pulse. When I realized that means you don't set off spike traps, I was like, golf clap. Well done.
Yeah, no, and that was a huge point in their favor, man. Like, if they had no foot pulse, I was just like, let's look at that. And also the one.
Yeah, where you can see, like, the parts of the floor you can drop through.
Yeah, where it's like, you can see, like, all the code, and, like, it's like, you know, you see the Matrix. You know, I'm like, ha, that's awesome. And Megan asked a question that I think that they were right to not go this direction. It would have been interesting, but it would have taken away from what the game is trying to do, which is make you constantly be chugging all of that, like, mental thought while you're like deciding, like, which one of my children do I want to carry on my name, you know, because that's basically in my mind what you're doing. But she said, like, so if you consistently pick one with like certain traits, are those traits more likely to come up? Because
what'll really bake your noodle later on is, will all your children be colorblind?
Exactly. And I was just like, I don't think so. Because then eventually you just stop seeing some traits altogether, which is not what they wanted to do. But I was like, that would have been interesting, you know, if you could like turn that off or on.
That is a time where going with realism would suck a lot of the fun out of the game, where it's like, oh, you just keep playing as colorblind people, so now you just have this overwhelmingly colorblind family. It's like, yeah, but that's not fun. Like, don't do that. Although I think they do have a bias toward the lower classes, because like the Hokages and the spell swords and like the mecha lich, like, they don't seem to come up quite as often as like the barbarian and the paladin and the archmage. So like there are some biases in the algorithm, but that I'm okay with. What I don't want to see is my choices eventually having actual genetic implications.
Well, and cause that's the thing is that, you know, like you said, Hokages come up less often. So when there is a Hokage, you're like, yes. But then you look and you're like, oh man, this guy's got, you know, like, is afraid of chickens and colorblind. That's going to be a pain, but it's a Hokage. I could also just go with this barbarian. Like, they they've got like these good things for them, but and so like you're just sitting there, and it's an actual honest to God decision, which is why when you couple that with the fact that the, you know, it is actually like a rogue, it feels odd calling it a roguelike dungeon because it's,
cause,
you know,
because it's a rogue legacy like dungeon.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, it is. But you know, so like I remember one time, like I got a Hokage. They were giants, which I loved that ability, you know, and I was just kind of like, it is time to wreck face because I've got a huge Hokage. Now is my time, you know. First room I came into, long hallway with spikes on the roof, spikes on the bottom, and platforms you had to activate.
Yeah.
And I was like, eat me, you know. So by the time I got out of that first room, I had like 20 hit points left, and then somebody else just iced me, and I was like, this wasn't, no, you were supposed to be the chosen one. You were supposed to bring me all the gold, not lose it, you know.
So I have a class question, or a class comment, and a trait question. My class comment is, I was incredibly disappointed by the spelunkers because I really wanted, because like I said, I was struggling for a while to like get enough money to feel like I was growing at a rate that was keeping the game interesting. And it actually didn't last as long as I thought it did, but it felt slow. Like there was a middle section of the game where I was just like, oh my God, like every playthrough, I'm barely raising any stats. I'm not finding any equipment. I keep screwing up fairy rooms. Like I was really irritated for a minute. And then when I unlocked the Spelunker, I was like, yes, a class designed for finding money. And then they just die, or you could just die. Like they just die. They die so easy. And I was like, this is counterproductive. I would rather play for 15 minutes with a barbarian and pick up five times as much money than play for 3 minutes with a friggin' Spelunker who eats it in like the first two rooms. Like it was just, I wanted it so bad. I was so disappointed. And I'm not like, I don't think it's the game's fault. I think it's like my lack of skill to have this super high risk reward character type that I don't have the skill to benefit from. But like, it was so enticing to me and I didn't get to enjoy it. My question is, what does it mean to be gay?
like what in-game?
No, we've just totally, this is now like a whole other podcast. No, one of the traits is is gay. Yeah. And the description, if you're a guy, says you like the men. And if you're a girl, I think it says you like the ladies.
Yeah.
But I could not detect any obvious difference in play. Like, I think there is a small chance that there's actually like some social commentary there. Like that is a trait that does nothing because why would it do anything?
Right. No, I think that along with the baldness, you know, is also a trait that
didn't seem to do anything.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything. And I think it does two things. One is I do think it does kind of make that commentary of it's like, yeah, you know, like this is a trait. This is a, you know, something that is, you know, like a something that is true about this person, but it doesn't impact their ability in any way to perform this task that you set out to give them. The same thing with like, same with being bald. And I think that having some traits like that means that it's kind of like throwing up a smokescreen, kind of, where it's like, so when you see something where it's just kind of like, you're afraid of chickens, it's like, oh, well, fine, whatever, you know, or you're afraid of birds, I think is what it says. You know, like, oh, well, maybe that's just another weird one. It's like, nope, now chickens run away from you. And it's like, well, darn it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
no, actually,
so I think that,
so I'm wondering now if I put on my, you know, the world is a good place hat, then I would say that was an intentional choice by the designers. I mean, it's a big staff, some of whom were probably gay, who said, we're going to include this just to make people obsess over the question, well, this person's gay, how are they different? And it's like, they're not. That's the point. they're not different.
That's the why is it called puzzles? That's the puzzle, you know? Like,
but if I put on my conspiracy theory hat, I wonder, because each generation, you choose your heir who succeeds you on your quest, but your other children still exist. So each generation, there are three children. It's just that only one of them becomes the player, right? That you play as. Right. I wonder if you choose an heir who is gay if you are guaranteeing that your next heir will not have any of their traits, because they can't have kids. Or, I mean, if we're talking about medieval fantasy universe with magic, so maybe they could magic a baby, but like, I would not put it past these developers who did all these other very, very clever, very, very subtle things to be like, oh, if you have a barbarian, a Hokage, and like a gay spellsword, and you play as the gay spellsword, the next generation will have no spellswords because the gay heir did not have any children.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. Honestly, I think that it, like the bald, it's just, you know, like there's no difference. It's just a unique trait for this individual. You know,
I would overwhelmingly prefer that interpretation. I would love for some developer or even the whole development team to be like, there's a bunch of, you know, bigoted douchebags out there right now obsessing over how is this gay person different. They're not different. That's the whole thing, like that. I really want that to be the truth.
Yes. The one final note that I have is just kind of to talk a little bit about, so like you said, like this is a rogue light, right? I really felt that the choices that they made on, you know, how you become more powerful, you know, like over time, I thought it was very well done, especially because you give up initially all and then eventually most of your gold to re-enter the dungeon, right? So the idea is that like you can't just do a million different runs and slowly blow this away. You do have to have good runs, you know? Like, because if you walk out of the dungeon with 800 gold and there's nothing that you can buy for 800 gold, then that was a useless run, you know? So like, you still get that feeling of like, yes, I got an amazing run. But then at the same point in time, you're not like, the minute that run is done, you're less likely to like put it down because it is building out over time. So I thought that was very cleverly done there. It's just kind of like, hey, spend as much as you want, you know, but you got to spend it all because you're going to lose it the moment that you re-enter the dungeon, you know. And I thought that was a good way to handle that.
And they have the additional wrinkle that you mentioned of you can get a stat upgrade or a skill upgrade that makes you give the demon, I can't remember his name, it's some of the C, that makes you give him less money each time, all the way down to, I think, 50%. So you get to keep half your money. Mm-hmm. And there's an item you can occasionally find in the fungin that will allow you to do one additional cycle without giving him any money. And right. I screwed that up twice where I forgot I had that and I went and spent down the money that I had. And then I was like, okay, I'm going back into the fungin and I have like 20 gold. And he's like, oh, I'm going to take all your gold. Oh, wait, you have my sigil. I'll let you keep it this time. And I was just like, damn it.
I should have held along to it. But yeah, I thought, like I said, I thought that was a really kind of good way to do that, because, you know, then when I start getting up to like the 1,000, 2,000, I'd be like, yeah. And then like when you beat a boss, you've got like 12,000 gold, you're like, yes, you know, it has that same feeling without being as punishing as the traditional game was, which was like, hey, you do a run. And then when that run's done, that's it, which makes you way more likely to just play the game for like 15, 20 minutes, put it down and then never come back. Whereas, you know, this time at the end of it, you're like, oh, well, I was level 20 and now I'm level 50, you know, and it makes a difference. You know, I thought that was a good way to give you some kind of permanency. But then also, too, the fact that it is your progeny, your heir that's taking it on. It's like when that character dies, they are still permanently dead. You will never. It is very unlikely that you will play that exact character, like that class, secondary ability and trait conglomeration again. That's probably not going to happen. That character existed and that character is gone forever. So I thought that they did a great job balancing that without being punishing.
Yeah. So we can we take a minute? I know we're running a little long, but I don't care. It's our show. Can we take a minute before we ask the last question, talk about the new game plus mechanic? Okay.
Sure.
So I'm going to start this conversation with a story. So I was struggling for a while. I just didn't, I wasn't collecting enough gold. I felt like each time I could maybe tick like one stat up or something. I just felt like I was friggin' plodding along. And then there was just this moment where the clouds parted and the angels sang and I had this just impossible serendipity. So I have spent zero time in the Underdark. I never went there because I never felt like I was confidently safe in the tower. So I eventually beat the first boss, and then I eventually beat the second boss, and then I struggled my way through the tower, and I did beat the third boss, and I was like, I'm not confident being in the tower. When in God's name am I going to be confident going into the friggin' Underdark, where I know the enemies are way, way ass harder? And so I'm, you know, traipsing about, just doing like run after run, trying to get as much gold as I can and just grind it out. And then I had this weird confluence of, I was a paladin, I was in excellent shape, I was hitting shockingly hard, and then I was exploring the forest, and I dropped down through the floor, and I was standing at the boss door for the Underdark. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a class that is good at fighting bosses, because if I screw up, it doesn't punish me that hard. And I have a lot of health. I think I actually even had full health and full MP. And then the Underdark boss is like weirdly easy compared to the other bosses, because it's just like the slime thing. Mm-hmm. And as long as you stay off the floor where the spike traps are, like, this is not that big of a deal. Oh, and
no, it's manageable.
And this paladin had ADHD, so he was like hasted. So that makes the spike traps even less of a problem, because you can just march back and forth swinging your sword like a crazy person and chopping the slime into smaller and smaller pieces. So I never experienced the Underdark at all. Like, I don't know what's down there. I don't know what it's like. Like, I just never had to deal with it. And then because I really wanted to try and have this beaten before we recorded this episode, I was like, okay, I'm just going to plow ahead. I'm going to go see what the last boss is like. And you get the very cool, like, you know, little story, and it was interesting, and I kind of like the little twist and the way they sort of like dig the knife in and be like, ah, we called it Rogue Legacy for more than just like, you know, nerd reasons. And I got there, and I died the first time, but I was like, I know what I have to do. Like, based on the way he moves and on my playstyle, like, I know what I have to do. And my next heir, I was like, yes, him. And then I gave him all the runes that he needed and the best equipment that I could equip him with. And I went in there and just annihilated the final boss, like both forms, nice, no problem. Nice. And I was like, this is weird, because I went from feeling like the game had ground to a frigging halt to skipping an entire area of the game and then just annihilating the final boss. And so I tell you all that to tell you this: when you beat the game and you get the new game plus, I was like, oh, this game has a new game plus. And then I messed with it for a second, and I was like, oh, okay, you basically just play the game again, and it's like a proper new game plus. But because I always complain that they don't include new game pluses when they ought to, this game is like the ultimate in... They would have been stupid to not include a new game plus, because scaling is a core mechanic of the game. So you just take the upper bound off of that, and you make the enemies get harder forever, right? And you make the gold drops bigger gold drops forever, and people can play. Like, I found some YouTube videos where people were on like new game plus like 50, 100, 150, like crazy, crazy numbers.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was the thing, is that when I just walked into New Game Plus, I was like, yep, this is what I thought it was. And then, you know, there, again, like you said, no reason whatsoever to not add it. So generally we would ask, does it hold up? But normally we now ask, did this game learn from its predecessors?
Yeah, I mean, short answer, yes. Like, not only did it learn from its predecessors, but they are trying so hard with this game to, I mean, this entire game, to me, knowing what I know about gaming history, which isn't that much, which says if I knew more, I would probably even be able to read more of this love letter. But I really feel like this game is like a love letter to Rogue specifically, but also like bullet hell games and kind of like these early arcade, like early computer games. And they were like, we want to just do this, but leverage all of what we have learned in the intervening, you know, 30 years of game design and game development and engineering and computing power. And they don't really, if you look at each of the individual mechanics, there's very little in here that is truly novel. What is novel about it is the combination of all of these things that had not, all of these flavors had not previously been in one stew. and someone took the time to make this stew with all of these crazy different flavors, and it turned out it's delicious.
Yes, no, I agree. Did this game learn from its predecessors? I mean, like, I think that this game in particular, I think when they said, hey, we're going to make a sequel to Rogue, again, you know, like with a new Metroid game or a new Castlevania game, like, this is some big shoes to fill, you know? And I think that they did it delicately and with aplomb. Like, I think that it's kind of similar to, in my opinion, and I'm sure that I may start a flame war here, but it's like the new Rocky Horror Picture Show. Have you seen that?
I have not.
In my opinion, I think it's very good, you know, because it took the old Rocky Horror. It did the same thing, but it did just enough new stuff to make it its own while still paying homage to it. And I think that this is that, where it's like they did enough new stuff where it's like, oh, well, you know, like it still has the same feel that Rogue had, where, you know, like, each run is unique and each run is important. Like, it's important that you do as well as you can on that run because it will help you in this other areas. But they still, like, infused it with some other things that make it a lot more enjoyable and not a lot more playable. And ultimately, I think that it has a great legacy.
The curtain falls. The music plays. The credits roll. Then it all fades to black. And you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone. There's no player two there by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head. From the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand. Your memories creep in with the edge of a smile.